All right, we're going to go to the book of Jude this morning. And I was telling Mom earlier, I was thinking about something completely different, and I had it almost wrote up and everything lined out for 4 weeks. And last night I got to reading and went about three books over and landed here. So now I got a four-week outline for the book of Jude, and it's still a little rough, but I think it's something that'd be worth talking about for sure. So bear with me this morning. I was telling her also, I've never taught before. I've always just preached, and so it's still a little different to teach over preaching. And so if y'all got something to throw in there or to clarify a little better, throw it in there. You know, we can all, it's a Sunday school class, we can all talk about it. But we're going to start this morning, Jude, number one. If y'all can find the second chapter, let me know. But it's verse 1 through 4 is where we're going to start this morning. And it's a short book, but it's got a lot in it. You know, there's a lot you can talk about in there. It's going to be, I feel like teaching it, it's a little more shallow than I'd like to put it across. But I think it'll be worth looking at for sure. So let's just start in verses 1 through 4 and go from there. It says, Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to them that are sanctified by God the Father and preserved in Jesus Christ and called, mercy unto you and peace and love be multiplied. Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto us by the saints. For there are certain men crept in unawares who were before of old ordained to this condemnation, ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's just one of the I broke it up into four different parts here because it's all one subject, but it kind of splits it up into different parts of it. And verses 1 through 4, it shows, for one, the salutation, and then the second one, the false teachers that have crept in. But we have to ask ourselves a question, because when this book was written, it was kind of the same way, too. They were being led about just any way they went by the false teachers. So ask yourself the question nowadays, why is the church seemingly failing, the real church? We have several churches around. You go screaming through Poplar Bluff, you pass five or six churches on your way in and through. But not all of them are what you would call a church. A lot of them are what they call a worship center or an auditorium. They don't call them churches anymore. If you drive by an unnamed church that is on my way to work, it pops up on there. There's a new series called Amplify. And come join us in our worship center. I'm surprised church is still on the sign. But everything, the only thing about that church is the sign. Everything else is called something different. We've come away from the word church. We've come away from the idea or concept of church. And everyone's gone more towards the idea of the church is not a building, it's a group of people. And that's right, but not the way they're using it and the way they're executing it. Because we're just a group of people, groups of people get to worship in different ways. That's why you got five and six different services. You got conservative, you got contemporary, you have youth, you have adult for different levels of maturity. And because we've broken it up into several levels of maturity, all of a sudden everyone understands on a different level, and we dumb them down ourselves. So why is the church failing? And we're not talking about closing their doors per se, even though they are, but I'm talking about why is the church no more than a social club or a feel-good location? Why is it failing? Is it because we've broken up? Is it because we've changed the name of what we call the church? Is it because we have come away from the idea? It's a culmination of all of it. I think one of the main things nowadays is we don't really know what we're looking for. When someone says, I'm looking for a church, what's the first question that's usually asked? Exactly. What do they got for the kids? Well, we have this, that, and the other for kids, and we have a service at 10 for the kids, and they get out at 10:30 and play pool or whatever while we go off till about 11, you know, because we're a little older. We know how to sit in church, and they go through it. And then the next question that the pastor asks to counter their question with the children and said, what are you looking for in a church? Well, mistake number one is that they asked them what they were looking for in a church instead of what kind of, you know, you don't ask people what they're looking for in church. It's not a menu. It's not a salad bar. It's not a smorgasbord. You just go up there and you pick what you want, and that's what you get. But nowadays in churches, that's what it is. And it changes, instead of coming to worship, it's come to making yourself feel better because you come to church on Sunday. And these people in this chapter were doing the exact same thing. They were changing the grace of God and lasciviousness and teaching how they perceived or their opinion of God and His grace was. Number one, I think that most people, what they look for in church, they don't look for the righteous first. They come in with not a judgmental spirit, but what they feel like is they weigh the people out and see how they like the people before, like, as soon as they walk into a church, they don't look at the decor as much as they do. They look at the people and make a snap judgment. So this is what I'm looking for right here. What kind of people should you look for in a church? Because that's natural. You come in, you look at the people, and you kind of figure out what you've gotten yourself into. I've walked into several churches over the course of my life, and even as a kid, you're like, what are these people like? Because some people have really pretty lights, but really mean people. Been there, done that. But if you walk in there, what's the people you should be looking for? Should you be looking at the people that come up and shake your hand and say hi? Or should you be looking for the people that say, hi, we got a class just for you over here, and yank you away? I've seen that, just lickety-split. Or should you look for the people that greet you, and should you have the right spirit, they testify with your spirit? Someone that will contend for the faith with you. Someone that knows the faith and knows what they're talking about. In verse 3 here, it says, Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. He had to write to them and tell you, hey, this is what you're contending for. This is what it is. And he had to exhort them and encourage them to continue in it because there were several people there that weren't contending. In a church, it's not so much about contending for the name of the church, but contending for the name of the church who rules, the name of the person who rules the church, which is Jesus Christ. When you have to constantly encourage somebody to contend, you're not contending. If you're not contending yourself, how can you expect anyone else in your church to contend? You have a preacher that will contend for the faith most times if you have a good preacher. But if he has to continually urge you and spoon feed you to contend, then you need to look at your own self and figure out how you're doing. In here, they had people there that weren't contending for the faith. And he had to constantly write them and remind them why. And I was talking about this to a friend yesterday. He said, if you look at two books of the Bible, there are some people in the New Testament that wrote letters to the church, not so much as to teach them and exhort them, but to remind them where they come from and tell them to live as they are now, not as they were. And I said, well, that kind of goes along with Jude, and that's kind of where it come from, where he had to write to them consistently to tell them that this is what you're contending for, where you're going. And so it's like, if you go to Peter a lot of times reminded them where they were and told them that's where you were, not where you are. Live for where you are, for who you're serving now, not who you served. And far too often, we hear preaching all the time that tells us where we were and that we've never actually left where we were, but we're supposed to live where we are, but they're still where we were chasing after us, and your past catches up with you and just keeps going on like that. And that doesn't encourage anybody. It's a pity party. That's all it is. And if you have that continually, then you're never going to grow. What is contending? Because you can say that all day, contending for the faith. But what do y'all think? You can speak up. What is contending? What does it mean to contend? It's fighting for. That's right. It's struggling to overcome, continuing the struggle, which means it ain't easy. Right. It's not something you just walk up and do. It's not something you can learn in a day to do. When you struggle, why do you struggle with something? Not just like, take it out of your mind. Why do you struggle with anything? Well, mainly because you haven't learned how to do it completely just yet. But do you give up? No. You learn and you struggle with a thing and learn more how to do it more perfectly without backing up. When you're struggling to push something and you're pushing on it, do you just take a step back and give up because you can't push that item? Or do you continue to struggle until it starts moving? I push cars sometimes that run out of gas. And some goober sometimes doesn't put it in neutral before he starts telling me to push. I sit there and I struggle against that thing, and finally I stop and I have to learn that generally when the parking brake's on, it's not going to move. You have to learn the process, learn how to do it right, and then it'll move, and it'll continue to move. When you struggle to overcome, you continue to learn how to overcome it. So contending is to have the goal or undying commitment to overcome for our faith. And it's to him that overcometh, that's true salvation. Salvation isn't a one and done deal. And I was kind of talking to him about that the other day. He said you have to continually repent, and that's true to a point. But if you're not struggling to overcome every day in every aspect of your life, then what's your salvation for? Through Jesus, you can overcome. And that's what he says here. You have to contend for your faith, which was once delivered unto the saints. And that is that the hope of Jesus Christ, you can overcome everything. It even says in Philippians, I believe, I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. So contending to overcome is not something that is lost to us. And it's not something that someone should have to continue. If you're struggling to overcome or contending for your faith, contending is a verb. It is not a noun. It's not something you start and then you stop and then you start and then you stop. If you're continually contending, it's a continual motion and it gains momentum. As you learn and as you contend, it gains momentum and you can keep going. And if you stop, you've just stopped. You have to start over. Because when you're pushing uphill and you stop pushing, it rolls back downhill. Been there, done that. And it hurts when it hits you too. You have to keep going. And that's what Jesus said. I give all diligence to write unto you. I put effort into this. To write unto you. To encourage you to contend for this faith. Because if you stop, there's no going back. And what we have to contend for is worth contending for. And it's worth the effort. It's worth the prize. And those are the kind of people you should seek out that know it's worth it. That's the kind of church you should seek out that preaches the truth and doesn't give up and never takes a step back. And as a church, we should strive to do the same. Far too often, we make what we call a revival push. But it's just, it's nothing. It's not truly contending. Because that's, everyone likes to say they go on a crusade with a revival. We're going to go on a crusade and we're gonna win this many people. We're going to win this many people and on it goes. When really, we haven't even won ourselves. The preacher rallies people to an idea, not a person. And if you rally someone to a person, that's really easy to slip back. A human person, I should say. I remember we used to have these week-long revivals, and by the end of 2 years, it was three-day revivals, quote-unquote. It wasn't really a revival. And we'd have this man coming in. I remember his name, but I'm not going to say it. And when he come in that first time and preached for a week, he preached heavy and he preached hard. And he didn't give up after 30 minutes. He kept going until the Spirit told him to stop. And we did have a really, really good, God met with us. Well, then he come back, I think it was like 8 months later. And the preacher made a comment before he come up and say, yeah, he preaches hard and heavy, but he needs to learn where to stop. And I guess he had talked to him before, because at 30 minutes he stopped and it was getting good. And then he come back again and it wasn't so good. And he come back again, it was a little lighter. And he got paid more, I guess. He got really good offerings when he started preaching a little lighter. But it just, you seen something quench you. You seen something stop. Because of whatever, I don't know if something was said to him or if his pay went up or whatever, he stopped contending so hard. And we got along that first time because he was true and he wasn't holding back. He was just a real person. Well, then he started watching what he said, and then he started taking a step back, and he lost his momentum. As a church, we can't afford to do that. The church is failing because we've taken too many steps back. We've taken too many losses into account. Losses that don't really count. If someone that is rich but stirs turmoil leaves your church, it is not a big loss. I'd rather have five poor people that want to serve the Lord than three rich people that just come for their own sanctity. In verse 1, it says that we are to be sanctified by God our Father, the servant of Jesus Christ and brother James, to them that are sanctified by God the Father and preserved in Jesus Christ and called. That's what the church is called to be sanctified by God. And they are preserved by Jesus Christ. If a church is serving the Lord, then we don't have to worry about going under. We don't have to worry about not paying the light bill. We've seen many times in this church alone that God provides for his people. Look for the people that are relying on God, not the preacher. Number 2, as a church, we need to know what to look for in a church the other way. Because all the people we know that serve well, there are people that have crept in unawares. In a church, we are a church family. You know, we are not separate church bodies, we're one church body, but we meet in different churches. And we can go around to all these different churches and see a lot of people that serve well and we get along with and we can fellowship with. And then you see those people that are in there, like I said earlier, for their own holiness, trying to get with themselves. As it says in verse 4, but who are these ungodly men? What are some of their attributes? That's an open question if y'all want to talk about it. They're blasphemers and make their own God to preach and serve. I've seen preachers that preach, and I've seen preachers that preach. There are preachers that preach and say the right words. They can preach exactly what he says right there, and it's right. But they're just saying it to get the favor of the people. There was this one church, the preacher left and took another church up in Arkansas. And so we had several preachers come in it was a really funny process, but they come in and preach for one Sunday, and then we voted on whether we wanted them or not. And we had some interesting ones. We had one, and I'll never forget this guy. He was Baptist in a can. He was like the picture of it. And he'd come in, and this is what I'm talking about. This is what every church wants to hear. He said he preached this every church, and he got voted into every church, but he's pastored 3 churches in 5 years. I'm like, thank you for telling that right off the top. So he come in, and his sermon title was His Eye Is on the Sparrow. That's true. That's good words. But he preached not the Bible, he preached the song His Eyes Are on the Sparrow. And he sit there and he sang, and he'd go like this, and while he was singing the song, and he did this number. And then it was like he preached like a poem. He'd say, God is a God of life, and he's watching you. His eye is on the sparrow. God's blessings will rain from heaven. In verse blah, 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 his eye is on the sparrow. And blah, 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 his eye is on. That was like every other. It was like a poem. Praise, his eye's on the sparrow. Praise, his eye's on the sparrow. We did this for 30 minutes. Why was he saying those words? Yeah, obviously. I won't forget that song. He said those words not because it wasn't what the Lord did not give him that sermon. If he did, then he was playing a prank on a few church members that day. Because everyone did this number in services the whole time. You know, is this guy for real? It was probably the most laughable church service I've ever been in. And no, we did not vote him in. But it was a wreck. Is he what you call a great preacher? And he said, and we asked him, because they had a little interview thing after the service and everything. He sat down in the front row, and you're able to ask him any questions. Why are you taking this church? That was always a question. What makes you want to come to this church? He said, well, y'all care about your preacher. I've seen the salary. I wish I was kidding. He is the first guy to come to mind when I read Ungodly Men. He was in business for himself. Three services a week, and there was three services in the morning because the power bill was so expensive and everything, so they started doing that. And then they go home and you read the Bible with your family or whatever you're going to do, and then you had church on Wednesday night. So this guy literally worked for 4 hours a week. The guy that was there before, you know, he would go visit hospitals and everything else throughout the rest of the week. He said, that's not really my job, that's a deacon's job. Because we asked him about that. He said, you know, we have people in the hospital and everything. He was just in it for the money. They gave him a place to live across the street. Ungodly men will not seek to do the Lord's will. They'll seek to do the Lord's will for their own, well, quote unquote, the Lord's will for their life, for their own profit. Ungodly men that have crept in unawares, that turn the grace of our God into lasciviousness. There is no grace of God in his preaching. You know what the grace of God was? His blessings, your happiness, and his eye was on the sparrow. His eyes were on the salary. We have to know what we're looking for. That is a blasphemer. And they do that and they serve their own bellies and lead people only to do the same in the name of God. And some of these men have poisonous doctrine mixed with a little truth just so it makes sense so you can maybe consider it. And say, well, that's not too far off. I've never heard it put that way before. And it's these men that have come in here and rewrote the church. And some of them are really good. They mix a little truth, but they mix a little bit of poison in there, just enough to get the people on their side, and then they can preach whatever they want. And they can make their salary and come back hard. Not all of them are that laughable. A lot more smooth-tongued preachers are out there. Not all, like there's this one evangelist that just came up and he just told jokes. He said, we're having a real good service, singing and everything, we had testimonies, and he got up there with his Bible and he slammed it down the pulpit and looked around for a second. And there were people wiping tears away and everything, and he said, man, it's too solemn in here. How about we just tell jokes for 30 minutes? And he shut his Bible. That ended it. He was a revival preacher. It was the third night of the revival. And then after that, he took up an offering for a steak dinner. That's how you get paid, by the way. If you're a missionary, you take up steak dinner offerings. I guess, because everyone does it. But that's just what we're dealing with. These ungodly men have taken over the church. I've said all that to say this. The ungodly men know what they're doing. Because most Christian men, quote unquote, don't study. They don't hold fast to the truth. They don't contend for the faith. They expect to come to church and expect everyone else to be contending for the faith so much that they don't have to. We always have that soldier that marches at the back of the line and hopes not to get shot because everyone else is supposed to be shooting first. You better study and hold fast to the truth and discern what is real and what's fantasy, because everything they preach is fantasy and they go right along with it and it ruins their mind. You shouldn't let the preacher spoon feed you and let you, I mean, a lot of them just do this. They give them an idea. They read a verse, and they say, and do you know what that means? And that leaves it open. Your mind, when I say, indubitably, do you know what that means? Most of you know what indubitably means. But when I say, do you know what that means? Your mind opens up. Because your mind doesn't know what that means, and they want to know. Whether you think you know or not. Do you know what that means? Yea, hath God said. And you can just plant it in there. And I've seen it so many times, they call it one-verse preachers. They come in there, they open their Bible, and they said, this is how you do, this is how the best service works out, the Spirit works in this. They say, now listen. They say, you pick a verse and you scream about it. And that's how you, that's good preaching. And it never is, by the way. Those who usually say, this is what I think it means, usually have nothing but their own mind to interpret it. The Spirit reveals as you search, but you can twist something in your own mind to fit an idea of yours into Scripture. We all know that. You can do it without a context. You can read a verse and scream about it and have no context, but you sure think it sounds good, and the people think it sounds good, so you get a big offering. Be careful to discern all you hear through these filters. The church is now filled with one or two of these people, and let's say that the second group fills the church. We have those church sojourners that can go through churches wherever they can make the best money, like that guy. And then you have the real preachers that stick with where God has put them. Us as church members should contend for the faith and know what we're doing. The first step to growing in your church is spending time and effort fellowshipping with those you know to be strong or strengthening Christians. Those others may have some words that sound good, but they can poison your mind faster than anything. Step one is read your Bible. Get encouragement to contend and want to contend for your faith. Not your church's faith, your faith. If Jesus is not your Lord, then you won't want to contend. A lot of people don't think lordship salvation is a real thing, but it is. In fact, it's the foundation of your salvation. Without Him as your Lord, you cannot be saved. And you can get kicked out of a lot of places for saying that. And if you can, you probably shouldn't be there. The Lord knows His ways. A lot of people want to live their own faith or whatever they want to do for good works. But know God and make a commitment not to be the ungodly man in life. And you have to see ungodly men. You have to open your eyes. Not every church is perfect, and every church has them. And they say, we don't have many people around here to do it. That's true. That's because most people that are ungodly men won't stick around with the kind of preaching we have anyway. Ungodly men don't always fit one profile. The Lord will help you to discern one way or another. And I'm not saying you have to be, not civil to them, but you better not make your way with them. The Lord's word will chase them out. And that's a whole other subject. But ungodly man is the first subject in Jude for a reason. And next week we'll see about their fate. But right now, you just have to learn to find the ungodly man. Single him out in your mind. Make an example of him in your mind. You must be strengthened in your own walk. Don't be looking everywhere else. Watch over you and your family. And your church. The church is a living body made up of families, not one man. But I tell you, families watch out for each other. As the Lord watches over and gathers, He said He would gather them under His own wings. Not because He likes us in particular, but because we are His family. We are His sons, His daughters. We've been grafted in. And as a church, we ought to be that way. The church is a family. And we ought to watch out for each other. That's all I got for this week.